2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
In today's episode of Project Recovery,
I was always the one that was going to go grab another beer or go grab a little more weed, and everybody else seemed like they were kind of at their level and they were content, but I never really felt like I had that stopping point.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery, and it's brought to you by our friends at knowyourscript.org. A wealth of knowledge if you head on over there to knowyourscript.org. Whether you're talking to yourself, your doctors, or your kids about the opioid epidemic, you can find it there at knowyourscript.org. I'm Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great.
Hey, so you're still, what, a couple weeks out of COVID?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you think you're a long hauler, or do you think you're doing better each day?
I feel like I'm mostly better. Occasionally, I'll feel a little wave of that fatigue that seems unnatural.
Mm-hmm.
But I am almost 50, so it could be that.
You know, and one of the things that happens when you get COVID is you lose your taste bud and your ability to smell.
Right.
But you've never had the ability to smell.
No, I was ahead of the game on that. I lost that when I was in my 20s.
And so,
but I don't think COVID affected my ability to taste things.
So. All right.
Yeah. So no, I'm doing good. Thanks for asking.
So the first part of the show, we kind of check in with each other. That's what we just did with you. And now I get to tell you what's going on in the world of Casey.
Yeah. See money. Bring it on.
So it's interesting because I don't plan themes for my weeks, but sometimes themes just occur.
Oh yeah.
So last Sunday, we're the lovely Leslie's. She's making a Sunday dinner.
Nice. What'd you make?
Mexican lasagna.
Oh, Mexican lasagna.
Yeah. Instead of
Tell me about that.
Instead of noodles, it's tortillas.
Uh-huh.
There's beans. There's meat. There's corn. There's cheese. There's some. I mean, it's amazing.
That sounds really good.
So afterwards, we're getting in the car. We're driving back to the house. I got all three kids in my car. And I very rarely have all three kids in the car because my oldest can drive now and she's got a boyfriend and she's kind of in those teenage years.
Right.
So I really cherish those times when we're driving because I get all three of them in kind of a confined space. A captive audience.
You know? I love that too.
And so we're driving, and I don't know how it comes up, and maybe it's the music or whatever, but Bowden, my youngest, goes, "Dad." I go, "Yeah." And it's my favorite when he goes, "Hey, Dad," because he says it at least 10 times a day.
He's been thinking something.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Dad. And I just know something's good is going to happen. Yeah. Hey, Dad. Yeah, bud. What's a buzz? He wants to know what a buzz is.
Okay.
Like when it comes to alcohol and drugs.
I was thinking haircuts for some reason.
No, no.
I don't know.
Well, I host a podcast called Project Recovery. So
yeah,
I
it makes
where,
a little more sense.
I knew where his head was. And she's like, "Hey, what's a buzz?"
Yeah.
You know, and then he wanted to know. And then we started this open conversation.
Where did he hear that?
I don't know.
It's just at school, maybe get a buzz on.
Or something. Or why would you do that? Why drink? And, you know, and maybe I said, "Well, to catch a buzz."
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he's like, "Well, what's a buzz?" Yeah. And then I had the hardest time describing what a buzz was to a 10-year-old. You know, and I said,
"Yeah, that might be really hard."
I said, I guess it's kind of where you feel good and you don't think and you don't really have a care in the world.
Yeah.
And he goes, "But why would you want that?" And then I had a hard time describing why you would want that.
Because when you get old, life's hard.
But a lot of people...
I know.
Get into it at young. And,
yeah.
And it got me thinking of, you know, the last episode we did where, you know, if you sat somebody down who was getting ready to try heroin for the first time and said, "Hey, the feeling's amazing. I'm not going to lie to you. The feeling's amazing.
But at the end, it's going to take everything you
own. Your life's a total wreck.
You still want it. But that's not how, you know. And so we had this great conversation about alcohol, about weed, about drugs, why people do it, and all that other stuff. And it was just it was a good conversation. And I wasn't really prepared to answer a lot of the questions.
Yeah.
But I did the best I could.
Kind of off the cuff, right?
Yeah.
Actually, what's really cool about that conversation, and it sounds like the way you handled it, is in the old days – the kind of the prevailing way to talk to kids about why not to use drugs and alcohol was fear-based. Yeah. And it wasn't true, actually. They would say things like, oh, it's horrible for, you know, you'll feel bad, and, you know, lie about, you know, and some of it's true, some of it's not true. But there was never addressing the reality of the fact that initially drinking or smoking weed, doing drugs, there's a reason that people do it, and mm-hmm. it makes you feel good. I think, personally, and I've read some things that back this up, it's better to give them the full picture and say, kind of like that, where you say, like, listen, you know what? There is a reason people drink, or there is a reason people smoke, and this, it makes them feel like this for a little while. But then all this baggage, all these consequences typically come with, you know, and you can use yourself as an example. You're like, look at my life.
Divorce, lost job, rehab.
It wrecks your health. I mean, there's all sorts of things. Accidents are more common when you're high or drunk, all these kinds of things. But if you hold back on telling them the true stuff, then guess what happens? When they go to a party and they try a drink for the first time,
they lied to us.
They're like, this is awesome. My dad was lying to me, you know.
What else is he lying about?
Yeah, and then they don't figure out until they're experiencing those negative consequences that you weren't lying. You were just leaving out a big part of the story.
So I told you about the theme. So then 2 days later, my phone rings and I pick it up. And it was a friend of mine that I went to college with, and she's married to one of my best friends, and there's this group that still hangs out together, and you know, for the past 30-some-odd years. And she goes, hey, what are you doing? I go, I'm just watching NCIS, because if I'm not working, that's usually what I'm doing.
Really?
Seeing what Gibbs is up to in the team.
Sure, you got to know that.
And she goes, hey, we all got together, and we were wondering if you would come and talk to our kids about the dangers of drinking and drugs.
Oh, really?
And I go, is there a big problem? They go, no, but they're at that age now where their kids are a little bit older than mine, where they're 17 to maybe 21.
Yeah.
And
going to parties, friends are using.
Yeah, we've tried to talk to them, but they just don't think that we're cool or hip, and we don't understand.
Right.
But you're all over Instagram and Facebook.
We need some C-Money action down in this place.
Yeah, you've got this podcast. We think that will relate to you. Would you be willing to come sit down and talk with them? And I go, you betcha. I go, but, you know, the thing is, I've got to be real with them, because they're going to know if we're holding something back. So I got to tell them how I know you guys, and that I've partied with you and all this other stuff. So you guys have got to be cool with that.
What did they say?
They go, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, they go, yeah. Because we've tried to tell them that, and they've seen us at family parties, and, like, we still all get together as a graduating class, or most of us graduated class type deal. You know what I mean? We get together, and there's drinking involved and stuff like that. But they go, I just think it would be really good to come from somebody who's had a certain amount of success and had it all taken away.
Yeah, I mean, your story is maybe a little bit more interesting to them than whatever their parents would have to say.
But I also think that they know, because I've been around these kids most of their lives, that, you know, they've seen both sides of it.
And
for me to sit down and go, well, this is the
thing. Had they ever maybe seen you at your worst?
Oh, I'm sure they have.
Yeah.
I mean, not at my worst, but in rare form.
In rare form, okay.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Where we got a little out of control, where that guy's bananas, Dad.
Right.
You know what I mean? That kind of conversation.
Your friend Casey's a little goofy.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so I said, you betcha, I will sit down and talk to him.
Cool.
So the theme of the week is talking to our kids.
And honestly, like the full picture. You haven't gone yet.
I haven't gone yet. I'll come back and let you know.
Okay.
But I said, but everybody's got to be on the same page. Yeah. If you guys are lying to them, or this is not going to work. But if I can sit down and talk about it honestly.
Well, I relate to that, because, I mean, you get a little full disclosure with your kids sometimes. It's maybe
scary.
Well, it's always scary. I think sometimes it's embarrassment of your own behavior. You don't want to model negative things. Sometimes you just kind of want to protect them from the reality of life in certain ways. But if you don't give a full disclosure about something as important as drugs and alcohol, sex, those sorts of things, you're not doing them any favors.
And it takes us back to one of our favorite extremists, Rob Eastman.
Yeah, we love the Rob.
And he will tell you, I'd rather prepare my kids for a war than protect them from a war. Because chances are...
Definitely sounds like a Rob
statement.
You know
what I mean? Chances are the war's coming, whether or not. And if we're not protecting them and preparing them, then we're not doing them any service.
That's true. And I can't disagree with that.
Nope. And so so I'll come back to you and let you know how that goes.
We want a full report. That sounds awesome.
You know, and during that whole
kind of... you get asked to speak to big groups often.
Yeah.
Have you ever been asked to just speak to a family or a few kids or anything?
I get a lot of people, hey, will you talk to my brother? Will you talk to my dad? My first question is, do they want me to talk to them? Do they know I'm going to talk to them? Yeah. And usually the answer is no. And I go, I can't do that. I can't just surprise.
I get that too.
I can't surprise somebody.
Mental health reasons usually. They're like, do you want to go talk to my brother who has bipolar and won't get treatment? And I'm like, not if he won't talk to me.
Yeah. I mean, if they call me, I'm going to go, hey, I would love to sit down and pick your brain. Let's do this.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to just show up at lunch.
I think that's one of the cool things, Kate. I don't want to like get your head any bigger because your hat's on, you know.
Yeah.
But one of the things I have admired about you in recovery, and this is you before as well, but like you're always willing to give of your time to help somebody out, and I think in recovery that's been invaluable to so many people.
But the truth is, it helps me more than it helps them so much.
Well, I think we could stop comparing that because it helps you tremendously and helps them tremendously.
Yeah.
It's just different, you know?
Well, the story we have for you today is an amazing story. I met this guy 2 weeks ago at that gala that I attended and Ken spoke at.
I feel badly to this day that I didn't get to go, but I was right on the heels of COVID and... Yeah, I was done.
He's got an amazing song. His name is Tyler Gould. We're going to hear from him, his experience with drugs, American Idol, and recovery. That's coming up right next here on KSL.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I am Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. Our guest today is Tyler Gould. Tyler, how are you, man?
Doing wonderful. Casey, how are you this morning?
All right, Tyler, we teased a little bit about you before we took the break, but let's just really before we get into your story, you spent some time with the American Idol people.
Yeah, it was a little short visit with them, and I was back in 2007. I was 15 years old, and that was kind of my first try at getting into some bigger realms of music, and went through three rounds there, which was just awesome. Awesome experience.
And you brought your guitar today. We're going to hear a song you wrote. It's called Tainted.
Yes, sir.
And it's a pretty amazing song. I sent it to you guys earlier so you could get a taste of it. But before we get to the music and the American Idol and all that, where does the story of Tyler Gould begin?
Awesome. Yeah, so I was born in Bellevue, Washington, just out of Seattle. And I grew up in Orem, but my family is originally from Hawaii and got to spend some time down there as well. But grew up here in Orem, you know, a pretty typical Utah childhood, I'd say. Had a great childhood, awesome parents. Grew up LDS, played sports, football, baseball, became a swimmer later on. And just, you know, I had an awesome childhood. That's kind of where it all got started.
How many siblings?
I had two sisters. One unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But I had a little sister, and I have a little sister and an older sister who, her name is Chelsea. She passed away now.
So. I'm so sorry for your loss. Where does your story begin? I mean, you said you had a pretty good upbringing, pretty normal high school experience. Did you ever dabble in?
Well, you said you were raised LDS, Church of Jesus Christ, the Mormons, right?
Yep.
And so that would mean in your household, I'm assuming parents didn't drink or use drugs.
No, absolutely not. I had family members, you know, uncles and things like that I knew did do those types of things, but I was never around it. My parents kind of tried to keep us from those types of scenarios.
What would they tell you about those kind of scenarios?
The best way to describe it would be that they'd give us warning. You know what I mean? I had a few uncles that maybe their lives weren't always put together in the best ways, you know, and they'd kind of, they would share that the reason why that's happening is a lot due to, you know, drinking or drugs or those types of things. And I think it was really important for me that my parents never belittled them in any way, never put them down, never made it sound like they were less than, but that the decisions that they were making led to them having
trials?
A hard time. Yeah, trials. Thank you. I was thinking for the word.
Well, that's pretty great because I think most parents are kind of like, hey, you don't want to end up like Uncle Frank, you know, and they do kind of put the family member down, but it sounds like in your family that they showed respect, but also maybe pointed out the reality of drugs and alcohol are taking a toll in this family member's life. Is that's pretty great.
Yeah, it was awesome. And, you know, I've been blessed and fortunate to have an uncle that now is, I want to say probably 14 or maybe 15 years sober now.
Yeah.
And he works at Cirque Lodge up there and helps so many people in the recovery community. So it's just awesome to have that example. He's helped me tremendously many times. So, you know, it's good to have family that has been able to support me through everything.
So how much sober time do you have under your belt right now?
Just a little over 2 years.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's been just been awesome, man.
But where does your story of addiction begin?
So I'd say about 15 years old. At 15, I got kicked out of school, and I actually was not using any drugs, but I decided that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I had an old ADD medication sitting around, and I thought, hey, you know, someone told me that those were worth a little bit of money. And I think that was my first addiction a little bit, was kind of that rush of being sneaky and trying to make a little money. Well,
diagnosed with ADHD and had been prescribed medicine and you hadn't been taking it. So it's just kind of sitting around.
Well, they changed my dose, right? So then it was just sitting in the cupboards. And I was watching Get Rich or Die Trying, I think. That 50 Cent movie that came out.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, man, that's so cool.
I'm going to make 50 Cent here in Orem, Utah.
Make some money. And had a high school girlfriend. Christmas was coming up. Man, I got to make some money so I can get this girl a present, you know. And that kind of, I think, started that snowball effect. Well, then they booted me out of school, and I was home doing packets, which is really where I fell in love with playing guitar, is when I had that time at home. And I really hadn't used any drugs, hadn't even thought about using drugs at that time, and just really got close with my family during that period. But it was right after they gave me a plea in abeyance on the charges that they gave me because I hadn't ever been in trouble and I didn't have any drugs in my system.
So for those of you who don't know, a plea in abeyance means it's like, if you don't do anything in the next 6 months, we'll forget this ever happened. But if you mess up, we're going to give you these new charges, and we're going to bring back these old charges.
Yeah, they really stick it to you if you mess up.
Yeah.
So it was like 2 days after that ended, I had some friends I was hanging out with that they wanted to try smoking weed for the first time. Someone got some weed, and we decided to try that, right? And right after that, I think anybody that's an addict understands that feeling of the first time where there was just like a little shift in the way that I thought. And the things that I wanted to do. And then, you know, the next weekend it was like, we added a little bit of alcohol in there. So it was about 15 years old where that chase, I guess I would call it, the chase for a high kind of began.
I want to stop you before we get more into your, you know, your abuse and, you know, the chase, if you will. But what he said, something very interesting before he did this, he goes, that was my first addiction, was into the lifestyle or into the money or into.
Right. I'm laughing a little bit because I'm realizing you're our first guest who's ever gotten busted for selling drugs before he ever used drugs.
I'm hoping that my wife doesn't get mad at me for divulging that little part of my story.
No, but I think that is a very insightful thing you said that Casey's picking up on, that there was actually there was something enticing, that like that whole like being,
well, it's mystical, being it's kind magical,
of a little
it's,
gangster
yeah.
and doing something cool like that,
doing
and being
something
sneaky,
that I shouldn't be doing,
subverting the law, breaking the rules, right?
I mean, and it started before even just like the money thing. I had some friends that lived right around my house, you know, right around the corner, who were non-members, and they got to go snowboarding every Sunday. you know, and they were out doing all this stuff on Sundays, and I was like, Mom, Dad, they've invited me to go. I want to go. They wouldn't let me do that, right? And I just was like, I'm missing out on some things, and there's something in my head, or my uncles would come into town, and they'd all go stay up at my uncle's cabin, and I wanted to go with some of my cousins that were, you know, they were 10 or 12 years older than me, sure, but I still wanted to go. I'm like, why can't I go be a part of that? And because they're probably drinking up there or whatever, you know, and my parents were trying to protect me from being around that stuff, you know, at that age. But I always had this desire to want to do that, and I loved to be sneaky. I mean, you ask my mom or dad, I was always doing little sneaky things, and they always caught me, always. My mom That's could just look too. At me yeah. and know that I'm doing something, you know?
Yeah.
She's still that way. Like, I could never hide anything from my mom. My wife's even better at catching me.
So 2 days after you end your plea in abeyance for the drug charges, where you weren't actually selling drugs, but anyways, you smoke weed. You said your first time you felt it, something shifted in your body, the way you think, the way you felt, and what you wanted. The next week, you added a little alcohol, and it sounded like after that, it was some kind of just off to the races.
Yeah, after that, it was like I dove head first into the lifestyle. You know, everything that they kind of thought I was doing that I got in trouble for started to become more of a reality. You know, I was doing all these things that people already had assumed that I was doing. And I think because there was that assumption that, oh, this kid probably is doing that stuff because you heard what happened, it was easy for me to just be like, well, I'll just embrace it. I mean, that's already kind
Lean
of the
into
label,
it.
Right? I mean, yeah, I'll just embrace it full-heartedly. And
when you're that age, there's something cool about being the bad boy, right?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, it got to a point where my parents told me, you know, I'm breaking all the house rules that you can imagine, right? Having my girlfriend over there, you know, past the time that she's supposed to be or whatever it is, you know, I'm sure they knew that I had, you know, substances in the home. And my dad and me started to argue a lot more. I didn't want to go to church. I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to do that. And he kind of got to a point where he said, and I love him for it because he was definitely trying to help me. And he told me, you know, we've got a standard that we live by in this home, and you need to abide by that while you live in this house. And I said, well, I don't think I can do that, so I don't think I can live here. And he was like, well, you know, that's your decision. And I don't think he ever thought that
you'd go.
I was
it.
Stubborn enough, right? And so I took off, man. I took off, and it was not for very long at first. I went and kind of hung out at some friends' houses or whatever. And then when I had my first car, it was I can't remember what year. It was probably a 2001 Mazda 626. I ended up sleeping in that thing for a pretty good amount of time, man, and had a little camp stove and a gym pass. I'd go shower and whatnot. And eventually, I ended up moving in with my uncle. It got a little bit too cold. But the back of that car, man, I birthed a lot of my songs and a lot of who I became over time.
How old were you when you said, okay, Dad, and you left?
I was 16. 16 years old. And
how did you feel? Like,
17.
Like, in retrospect, obviously, you recognize your dad was trying to help you and you love him for his efforts, which I think is a very... You know, that definitely shows you've processed that experience and whatnot. But how did you feel at the time, like when your dad's coming down with all these rules and stuff?
I had watched him help my uncles through numerous things, right? And always seemed to be supporting them and trying to do that. And although I know now in hindsight that he was trying to do the same thing to me and I wouldn't allow him to help me, right? Because I just didn't want to listen to anybody. At the moment, I felt like, what the heck, Dad? You know, or Mom, what? You guys can support them in this, but you can't support me. You can't accept me for who I am. This is who I am, you know, and thought my whole identity was wrapped into those behaviors. When, you know, in reality, that's not the case. But I don't think I ever blamed them or was upset or angry with them. But I had a lack of understanding. What was the hardest for me is, why am I this way? But they can't accept that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that I was blaming them for anything. I had siblings at the home. You know, they're trying to protect them and their standard of living. And ultimately, they were just trying to help me, you know. But it was tough. It was tough for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, and part of that I think we can chalk up to being, you know, middle teens, you know, you're 16. It's kind of a rebellious, don't tell me what to do kind of time. It also sounds like maybe there was an aspect just of your personality. You, like you said, you love to be sneaky, you love to push the limits, all that kind of stuff. So it's sort of a perfect storm for butting heads with a parent.
And, yeah, absolutely. And we get along great now. I mean, and we have for a lot of years, you know, even through some of my lowest points of addiction, they've always been right there to support me.
So you move in with your uncle.
Yep.
How's that go?
It was a lot of fun for me. I was living right up at Provo Canyon on the river, you know what I mean? Right next to that rock that everybody swims at. But he was a huge support for me, you know, somebody that I could lean on. And he knew that, you know, we were breaking his rules probably too a lot of the time. But at that point, it wasn't really, we weren't doing anything crazy per se, right?
So just, I guess the kids would be social drinking, social using.
Yeah, absolutely.
At that point, it hadn't got its claws into you yet.
I think it had its claws in me because I was always the one that was going to go grab another beer or, you know, go grab a little more weed. And everybody else seemed like they were kind of at their level and they were content. But I never really felt like I had that stopping point. You know, it was just kind of like until
off button.
It was time to go to bed or because I got put to bed. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That was the stop point for me. And it was just kind of always.
What was happening with school at that time, high school?
I was trying to pretend like I was going to school, but it was not happening. You know, I was doing my best, but my uncle, when I moved in with my uncle, and I think him and my dad probably decided that I needed, if I wanted to act like an adult, then it was time to be an adult. And so I think it was like $300 a month I had to pay for rent. And I had a job, you know, and
that's a little steep, though, for a high school kid back in those days.
Yeah, right? I think the plan was I'm going to send him home. And I'm pretty sure that my uncle ended up, I can't remember exactly. I'm sure he ended up lowering it and just, you know, to help me out or whatever. But
the plan probably was that he's not going to be able to come up with.
Put the pressure on him.
Yeah, $300.
Exactly.
He's going to have to put his tail between his legs and come
and
back.
Go home. Yep. Well, instead, I just ended up leaving school. Which, you know, I ended up going back and getting my GED, which I'm grateful for, so that I could, you know, pursue some college courses and things like that. But ultimately, that's what it ended up leading to, is just I'm falling more and more behind, and it just wasn't worth it for me. I was in high school, primarily, I played baseball for a while, and I swam. I became a swimmer, and was actually not a bad swimmer. I was pretty good at that, but it just got to the point where, like, I wasn't able to go to practice. I wasn't doing it. You know, it just got too hard to keep up.
And was that just a general rebellion that was causing that, or was this, do you think, part of the drinking and smoking and all that?
It was both. It was both for sure. I got to a point where I was working at a sandwich shop called The Italian Place. Love that place still. But I also, my dad had a metal fabrication business at that time, and he let me come into work for him. Which ended up being a huge blessing and a great place to learn a lot of things. But I started making an okay, you know, amount of money, especially for 16, 17 years old by that point. And I thought, man, school, what for, man? And then, I was like right around the time I was about to turn 18, I found out some friends were going to move out to California to sell alarm systems. And, I decided, I'm going to go do that too.
Ah, the lure of summer sales.
Yeah, absolutely.
I knock ink, door to door.
Yep. I think a lot of people, you know, have tried that.
So you find yourself moving to California with a bunch of buddies.
Yep. And they were still in school. So I knew one of their older brothers that was out there already, and they had already started working, and I wasn't in school. So I figured I'm going to go out ahead of them, right, a few weeks.
Let's jump into that after we take a break.
That's right. You're listening to Project Recovery. This is a story from Tyler Gold. So you're headed to California.
Yep.
And you're going to go out 2 weeks in front of your friends with some older kids, I guess.
Yep. Well, and, you know, keep in mind, I'm going to California, to Corona, California.
Yeah.
So in my head, I'm thinking California, man, I'm going to be right on the beach. This is going to be so good. And, you know, it's going to be so much fun.
Suntans and bikinis. Yeah.
I get out there, and Corona is not like that at all, if anyone's ever been to Corona, California.
Right.
And I'm like, what is this? You know, and But I had a lot of fun, and everybody's older, you know, people are having parties and drinking and doing whatever. Long story short is the first night I'm there, I get into my new apartment. There's no sheets on the bed. There's no, you know, nothing. They told us that they provided an apartment that was furnished, right? So I'm thinking stuff's going to be there, and that's not the case. And immediately I'm calling my dad. I already didn't have enough money, right? That I don't got sheets. I don't got anything. And I'm thinking, what did I just do, dude? I'm over my head. And, you know, what ends up happening is I end up hanging out with the wrong people out there doing dumb things, and I end up getting fired about 3 weeks later. And my dad reached out to a friend. I got another job, and I ended up going to Pennsylvania working for APX, which is now Vivint, right? And ended up finding a little bit of success out there. Then came home and had a little bit of money and too much time on my hands, and then everything just started back over. And then it just got, and it got worse, and it got a lot worse.
Got worse in what sense? Like what was not going on?
I think like I dabbled with some of the harder substances prior to that, just here and there. But
were you introduced to something for the first time out in Corona? Like did you start?
Yeah,
using
I got into
any?
The pain pills, and I had gotten into it a little bit before that, but it's hooks in me a little bit more then, and I didn't really even understand that at that point. Kind of had me. But then when I got home from that experience selling, I got involved with just another group of friends, and we all kind of, there was a few of us that kind of wanted to start trying new things, right? And then we met some people that were already doing those things, and I moved into a house with a buddy who's actually the co-writer of Tainted. His name's Madison Mon, and the house that we lived in, which would have been about 2012, really became a place that created a monster for me. It just got out of hand. We had a lot of fun. We had a recording studio in there, played a ton of music, you know, but,
what were the drugs that were floating around that house?
You name it. I mean, everything, meth, heroin, cocaine. I mean, it just, and I started doing some of those things in secret, where I got into doing, you know, other things behind some of my roommates' backs or whatever, you know, and it just kept spiraling to the point where it strained my family relationships. It wrecked relationships with friends, romantic relationships, which I'm grateful for those things ending and putting me into a position to get me to where I'm at now. I think 7 different times in and out of treatment centers.
So you've been to treatment center 7 times?
7 times. I think I've probably finished maybe 3 times.
What brought you to your first treatment center? Tell me about that scenario.
So I was at a point where, some things in my life had fallen apart. The situation that I was in just kind of crumbled. I had a job and I did something stupid. I got fired, and that created a ripple effect through my life.
I'm just going to say, what did you do? Now, I don't want you to share anything that you feel embarrassed sharing.
No, it's fine.
But I know sometimes people just gloss over that, and it can be an important part of the story.
I was getting sick, right? And I thought there was this person that came and paid part of a bill on an account, and we weren't going to close it out until they came and paid the rest. So there was just some cash sitting there, and it had been there for like 2 months. So I thought, okay, I get paid in like 4 days. I'm going to borrow some of this.
You're getting dope sick.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to borrow some of this cash, and then I'm going to go get feeling better, get my fix, and then when I get paid, I'll just put it back.
It was your own personal payday loan.
Yeah. Well, it just so happened that the next day, the manager decided to just close that account and write it off. So when he went to go get the cash, and it wasn't there, they started looking at the cameras and they started doing all these things. And I actually went and I got the money and I put it back. And I said, hey, guys, I found it. It just fell behind the change box. You just weren't looking hard enough. Right. And well, they saw the whole thing on camera. and nonetheless, they let me go. Right. So after that happened, some other things came out. You know, people that were in my life at that time started finding out that I was doing dumb things. I was just being a knucklehead.
So at that point, were you still just on pain pills, or did you transition into heroin?
No, at this
heroin?
Point, it had graduated. So when I was in that house, everything changed there. That's when I found
you said the house that created a monster.
Yeah, and
I'm sensing that you're feeling a little hesitant to talk about that because we chatted for quite a while before we started. I can tell you're a really nice guy, a good person. And I think it's probably hard to think about the things you did that hurt other people in your lives or the dishonest behaviors.
Well, it's that. And then, you know, I've got kids now. I got stepkids that are older. They understand things. They know that I'm trying to be in the public eye and that I'm pursuing those things. And some of those things are details that, like, I don't feel in a public setting are so important.
Right. Right. But
I mean, maybe they are. And if they are, then I can dive.
No, I'm not trying. I'm just commenting on the fact that for a lot of people, that is one of the hardest parts of getting 100% good with yourself during recovery is also reconciling. How could I, a really good person, a person who, you know, feels positively towards others, have done these things? It's hard. And I know Casey's struggled with that. I think everybody we've brought on the show struggled with that. It's
for sure.
It's tough. And I just want to commend you for actually having a hard time talking about it, because that kind of shows that that's not part of who you feel like you are anymore. That was my only comment.
Well, right? I appreciate that. And it's not that I'm not ashamed of anything that I've done because it's brought me to where I'm at. That being said, I'm not ashamed of the actions that I've done, but I'm ashamed of the effect that it's had and the ways that I've wronged other people.
I get that 100%.
Because it just is not at my core. Anything that I had done in the middle of the storm, I'll call it, wouldn't be something that I would even entertain the thought of today or in my sober mind. It's just not a part of my DNA. But when anybody that's used substances before, especially some of the little more gripping ones, they know that part of your DNA gets bypassed a little bit. That moral compass gets glossed over.
Well, I like what you've said a couple of times, and that is that you don't regret those things because they brought you to where you are today. And that's one of the most healthiest.
Yeah,
that was.
Look to me for grammar.
I think I got a B+ and yeah. C in English or something. But it's such a healthy place to keep your focus, because regretting the past, I mean, what can we do about it, right? And people who focus on the past have a lot more depression. But being in the present and accepting that, hey, maybe I'm in this good place because I grew from some of those bad experiences.
Well, not only that, but I mean, it's connected me with. Look, this is how I met Casey. You know, mm-hmm. This is how I've met you, is because of those experiences. And I've always felt this way, that not only just through my music, but part of my personal, I guess, goal and mission in life is to be able to grab on to some light that's out there in the universe and be able to take that into places that needs it the most. And I don't think I would be able to do that just by, if it would have been just me observing some of my family members struggle through those types of things, or my friends struggle through those types of things, because I wouldn't fully understand that pain and that struggle and that hurt. And I wouldn't fully understand what it's like to be tainted. And that's where the name of that song came from, is from feeling that I was just a little bit different than, especially in the community that I grew up in. Right.
So let's not focus on the 7 rehabs. Let's focus on what you learned from each and every one of those rehabs. Because, you know, we've had people in here that have been to 3, 5, 6. I think the record is 12. You know, but every time they go, I learned something every time. I wasn't ready for the message, or I wasn't ready to, you know, to start my road to recovery, but I did learn something there. So I'm assuming you learned something in all those recoveries.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say the first couple I only went because my parents agreed to come and bail me out of jail if I would go get help, right?
Which is that's a pretty common story.
Yeah, everybody.
And I did not want to be in jail, you know? I don't think anybody does. And so that was what got me there. And I left like 2 weeks later, right? And then I went back, and then I did the same thing again. And finally, I said, I think the only way I'm going to be able to do this is if I get out of state. And
that was too easy just to run home, right? Because you got friends and people around.
Absolutely. And some of that was probably an excuse to be able to go somewhere new. I love to travel. I love going new places. But each time I did learn something new. Not only did I connect with more people and learn that that connection is so important, what I really learned, I think, the most at first was that my family was not going to give up on me. And I've been super blessed to have that, because I know a lot of people do not. And I've seen that and witnessed that, is people just don't have that support. But that was the first thing I learned. The next thing I learned is that I could do life sober. You know, it was really hard concept to grasp, but I kind of started to realize that I could do it, right?
You could make the music. You could have the fun. You could, yep. you know what I mean? That was, for me, that was one of the toughest blocks for me to climb, was what does sober life look like? Because I'm not going to lie, I had a lot of fun partying. And I thought, well, I'm never going to have fun anymore. That's what sobriety, before I got sober, meant to me. I'm not going to have any fun mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah, because we even use that word, like, you know, for an attitude, like a sober attitude is somebody who's not a lot of fun to hang around with.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was like, what, you mean you guys for fun? No. Okay, cool. And so, but you found out you could do it.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing that I think kept pulling me back in every time is that I had my friends, and, you know, some of those friends, I'm like, these are my brothers, man. We've been through hell and high water together. And I can't just walk away from them.
What kind of friend would I be if I just walk away
from them? Absolutely. I can't start treating them differently, because I hate it when people do that to me, because I struggle with things or whatever it might be, right? And that was really hard for me to, and still is hard for me. But I've learned that I just have to protect myself, and I have things to me today that are more important. You know, I've been so lucky. So after all the rehabs, I was doing really well. I came home for a little bit, and my plan was, I'm going to Hawaii. I'm going to go to Hawaii, and I'm going to go connect with my roots, and I'm going to go see that place. I'd never been. And I thought, you know, this is what I'm going to do. I had a cousin that was living there, kind of reached out to her. She kind of thought, this is what you'd need to come down and do this. She ends up coming here for a Young Living thing, and tells me, you know, why don't you come back? At the time, I was doing pretty good. I was drinking a little bit here and there, you know, but keeping things together pretty well. And, but I was going to go to Fiji with my brother-in-law's mom, to go help them do some stuff out there and just kind of get away, you know, for a little bit and kind of get some time under my belt, essentially. Right. That kind of fell through. And, my cousin came about the same time that I found that out. And she said, why don't you come back to Hawaii with me? I said, okay, I got a little bit of money saved. Not a lot, but I got a little. And she's like, that's probably enough. Like, you can come stay with us for a while. I said, okay, perfect. I'm going. So it was like the next week I was on a plane and I was going to Hawaii. And my plan was to really go down there and connect with where my family's from, my dad's side, and to write music. I wrote a song back in high school called Simple Dreams. That was the plan to be my first album name, was Simple Dreams. I thought, what better place could I ask for than Hawaii to be able to write an album called Simple Dreams, right? So I stayed with my cousin for a little while, and then I didn't want to get a job, right? I just wanted to be in the ocean all day and play my guitar on the beach, and so I ended up leaving there. And long story short, I spent about 2 years sleeping in a hammock in a banyan tree. With wow. my guitar.
Wow.
And was just, to be honest, was a beautiful experience for me. I think I always had that desire to kind of just live like that and to understand people from that point of view. And I kind of went there with initially the plan to see what it's like to live in a way that, as Americans, we're not accustomed to so much. Not most of us anyway. There are definitely some that have that struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to see life through that point of view. You know, I lived in my car. I'd done this. I'd done that. But I had family here to bail me out. I had this or I had that, you know, that kept me a little comfortable. I was like, I'm going to get down in the nitty gritty. And I got a little carried away, you know, and I started making bad decisions down there too. But it just taught me so much. I ended up getting a phone call from my sister that told me she had a dream with my grandpa who passed away like a day or two after I was born in the same hospital. And that in that dream, she was told to tell me to just hang on, to not give up, to just hang on, because things are going to work out in the way that you keep seeing them in your head. And it was really an impactful phone call for me. And then I got another phone call a little bit later from my parents that said, your sister Chelsea wants to run an Airbnb in Vegas for Thanksgiving, and we want you to come home. We're going to buy you a ticket.
Is she the same sister that had the dream?
Yeah, same sister. Yep. And I said, okay, I'll come home, but here's the deal. I want a round trip ticket because I'm coming back. This is where I want to be. This is what, you know, and I know I need to get out of this hole of being homeless, but this is where I want to set my roots down. And they said, okay, we'll get you a round trip ticket, but just here's your flight. Make sure you get there. Right. And I end up making it on the plane, barely, but I got there and got to Vegas and just immediately was greeted by my sisters and my parents all came to pick me up from the airport. And was just almost overwhelming. I mean, it was just so good to be embraced and feel loved again from spending so much time just by myself. You know what I mean? And not always alone, but essentially alone, you know? And
sure.
Then they kind of had a, okay, we're going to sit him down. We're going to get his butt home. Right. And
do you think this was kind of an intervention?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think my sister, in a lot of ways, I think she probably felt inspired to set this up, because I think she probably knew in the back of her mind that I'm not going to go home. Right. But if she could get me with them, then maybe she could get me home. Right.
And we're going to find out what that looks like. Hang on. You're listening to Project Recovery. So your sister's job or thought was, if I can get him to Vegas, I can get him home.
Yep. And they sat me down. And they told me, dude, what are you doing? You had some time under your belt. You came home. You were working hard. You were keeping things together pretty well. And you just kind of gave up on it. You know, you just got too antsy. You went to Hawaii before we told you you should. And you just kind of gave up on trying. And you know, I had every excuse that I could think of on why that wasn't the case. But ultimately I told him, I think I'm ready to come home. My dad's like, well, I don't know if we're going to take you.
You know, they set this all up and they're like, yeah, I don't know.
Like, you know, and I don't blame him because, and I don't know if that was the plan ever, or if the plan was originally to even let me come home, or if it was just to kind of see where I was at. But he told me, he goes, I don't know if we can do it again. You know, how many times have we brought you back home and have we helped you and have you wronged us? You know, things go missing. You know, you're doing things in our house that are against our standards. You're bringing friends over there. You know, it makes your sisters that are at the house feel uneasy, you know, and I don't know if we can do it. You know, and I wasn't mad at that. And, you know, of course, I'm like, well, it's not going to be like that this time. It's going to be different. You know, I'm going to be better. And I came home and I was a little bit better, you know. being in Hawaii gave me a lot of time away from opiates. It gave me a lot of time away from opiates, which was a huge blessing. And there was other things down there that kind of got their hooks in me, you know, the amphetamines and cocaine down there are a little bit more accessible, I would say. And those got their hooks in me a little bit. But it seemed like, for whatever reason, I was able to manage that a little bit better. And I had a little bit different perspective when I came home. The problem was, is when I got home, one of my first phone calls was to some of my best buddies that I used to live with in Provo. And I'm not blaming them, because they tried so hard to keep those things away from me and to not do that. But it was me that was instigating that I wanted to get back into that, right? And I started to kind of just here and there. I was really cautious. I was really cautious at first because I knew better. You know, I had been given enough tools through my stints at treatment centers and from my family and from therapists and counselors and mentors that I knew, what I was doing was slippery. And then my sister Chelsea, who was the one that arranged for me to come home in a lot of ways, passed away. And I just got shattered. I mean, it was just devastating. And
can I ask, excuse me, can I ask what caused her to pass away?
She had a lot of health issues all growing up. That brought me really close with her, you know, because at the same time that I was home in that junior high school age that I got kicked out of school, she was home because she had health problems. So we were both home together for over a year, and that really brought us super close together. And, you know, my little sister, I have to say, my little sister Hannah, she's always been the one that was like, I knew wasn't judging me or like mad at me. It was kind of like my little ride or die and supported me through so many things. And my older sister was the one that always caught me, always busted me, always coming in the window, whatever it was. But her health issues, just she had, I mean, 3 open heart surgeries. And at one point was having like 100 seizures a day. And then there was a lot of years that went by that she was doing really well. And she had a little baby girl and was married. And she just slipped away one night.
Wow.
Don't really know why. Don't really know what happened.
And that devastated you.
And it just tore me up, man. It just, I mean, my whole family, of course. It was unexpected. We had no idea. And I kick myself today because she had an old MacBook Pro, right, that she told me she would give me and I could make a few payments to her for a few hundred bucks so that I had a machine to record music on. And I called her one night and she said, yeah, you can come by and get it. She barely had a voice. She's like, I've got the flu really bad. Could you just go to Target before you come over and get me like some soups and some cold medicine and maybe some Powerade, right? I was like, yeah, no problem, sis, I got you. So I went over to Target, and for whatever reason while I was there, I just felt like I'm going to buy a bunch of things. Like maybe, you know, my brother-in-law likes Reese's. I'm going to get him some candy or whatever. I'm going to get a whole bunch of ramen noodles and, you know, all this stuff. And I just kind of started loading up the cart. It wasn't a whole bunch because I didn't have a lot of money, but it was more than what she had, like, asked me to get. And I went over there, and I called her, and I said, hey, I'm here. Her building was kind of secure, and so I called her, should I come up? And she's like, well, I'm so sick. I don't want you to get sick and baby's asleep. And I'll just have Devin, which is my brother-in-law, run it down to you. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And I'm waiting in the car. And he brought me down the laptop and told him I love him. And I went home, right? And that night, she passed away.
Oh.
And I just am like, man, I wish I would have gone upstairs. Maybe I would have noticed something, maybe this or that, right? You play out all these different scenarios.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I went through that, I started to really kind of slide downhill. And then at her funeral, I ended up meeting my wife. So she ended up adding me on Facebook a few days after the funeral, had seen me there, was friends with someone that was really close with my sister, and she was close with my sister, used to work together at a doctor's office. And we ended up going on a date, and at the date, she ends up telling me, so I have a confession. I knew your sister, and that's how, you know, I kind of added you on Facebook. And when she added me, I just straight away messaged her.
Because she's hot?
She's beautiful, man. I mean, she's just so hot and gorgeous, you know? And for whatever reason, I was just so intrigued, right? And, well, not for whatever reason. There's plenty of reasons. She's just gorgeous. And we ended up going on a date, and we ended up spending a whole bunch of time together right after that. And as I started spending more time with her and less time with other people, I started to put a little more distance in some of those habits that I had picked back up, but that I was hurting, man, you know, and I end up just sliding back downhill, you know, and I get back into doing opiates, and she busted me, you know. We're starting to date pretty serious at this point, and she busts me. She calls my parents, you know, and here we go again. And I'm thinking, every time they found this out, it's like I'm going back to treatment.
Yeah.
Right? Well, my wife ends up getting me some help and without having to go away to treatment. And, I mean, really, I have to give so much credit to her and my parents, too. But I mean, she saved my life. She just didn't give up on me. You know, she gave me just enough trust to let me try and figure it out, and gave me enough time to figure it out, and gave me a few of the tools that I was just missing, you know, and we've got a beautiful life now together. You know, I've got.
So you didn't go back to treatment, but I think it's interesting to know what you did do. Like, she gave you trust and she was supportive, but were there, was there more to it than that?
Here's the biggest difference for me in this time when I've gotten sober and every other time. The first thing is I was just so burnt out of the lifestyle.
Sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Absolutely. I mean, beyond, right? Even when I started to slip up again, I was like just in agony every time I'd slip because I'm like, what am I doing, dude? I know better than this. I just know better.
And I don't really want this, but it, I get it.
But it's just burying other things that were going on, you know? And I think some of that was, the other thing was to just face head on that that's who I was, that I had problems with that. And that was, had been my coping mechanism for so many years. And I had to learn some other things. So I dove heavier into my music and I dove heavier into my relationships. And I started working harder. You know what I mean? I got, instead of just working on music, I got a job, you know, and I started working. And I think the other thing that really was a huge shift is I started to see myself in a way that I felt that I deserved more than what I was letting myself have. I stopped letting these labels and all this negative energy just hang on me and started remembering all the things that I envisioned in, while I was in Hawaii and all the plans that I had made and all these things and realizing that I'm supposed to do those things and I'm supposed to have those opportunities. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with the things that I've done. And it's just time to make a shift, right? And I tell people when I'm having hard days, you know, and little things here and there that that just keep me safe. And I surrounded myself with people that wanted to help me and that I could trust. And I let them help me. That was that. I think humility was the biggest thing that made that shift for me, was I just finally got humble. And I just finally started to listen a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that's a big deal.
Well, it represents a total shift in thinking about yourself. And it, I think you use the word humility or humble, but I think it's also just kind of a new reality. Like you are, you know, we've said it, I say it all the time, thoughts, feelings, behaviors, how you think about things has a direct influence on how you feel. And those feelings determine our behaviors, right? That's how we all live. And so that's all fine and good as long as the thought process is healthy and grounded. But right. When we're off base, you know, when we have the addict brain in play, when we have the rebellious brain in play, then we end up doing things that aren't in anybody's best interest. And it sounds like through that relationship and the support that you were provided, probably also a culmination of being sick and tired of being sick and tired for a lot of years and all of those things, there was a real shift. And you became a much more grounded person who was willing to say, well, I should reach out when I have a bad day and I should be authentic and honest with people. And that's brought you maybe more to a place of self-care than you had before.
Well, when you think about it, at 16, he was living in his car, told his parents he couldn't live up to their standards,
right,
and live
right.
in their house, and he was going to go do it himself.
I mean,
and
we were all rebellious at 16, but I wanted to live in my bed.
Yeah. And then he followed that throughout, you know, the next 15 years. Where he would, you know, live 2 years by himself.
Well, I'm still processing the fact that you slept in a hammock for 2 years. Like, I mean, it was Hawaii. It wasn't Salt Lake.
I had the setup,
was,
I'm telling you.
Yeah, it was, sounds pretty nice.
I had a hammock. I had a shower head strung up on a hose up in a banyan tree with a little plastic pallet. I'd boil my water in a bucket and pull it up there on a pulley. I mean, I had a hot shower every day, man. It was
You know how to live.
I had the setup.
But it took you.
It takes a toll on a person after a while.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
that.
It was
just kind of
only fun for about 3 weeks.
Unfocused. Living is exhausting, right?
And so you dove back into your music, you got yourself a job, you got married, and recently you just brought a little baby girl into the world.
Absolutely. So first I had the opportunity to be a stepdad, which has just been a huge blessing. And then, yeah, I got about seven weeks ago, I got to bring a little girl into the world. Yeah.
That's exciting.
And it's been a whole new thing. Someone asked me last night, how's being a dad and having a new baby? I said, well, I'm just trying to learn how to juggle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask you this. You know, in recovery, and you've been to 7 treatment centers, so you know a big thing they talk about is your aftercare.
Yep.
So what does your aftercare look like? How do you plan on staying on this sober road?
You know, it's funny you ask that question, because what I was taught in treatment, to go to the meetings and to do all those things, I totally agree with. I think if that's what helps you, absolutely do those things, you know? But I think you really have to find what works for you. To be perfectly honest, that path, the typical path for me, wasn't working. And maybe I'm a unique case, and I don't think that that's the case. I just think that I found people that I could get the same exact thing that I was getting at meetings from at my home life, from people that I connect with, from relationships that I have. It's more like I've put myself in a position where I can always be at a meeting if I need to with a phone call, you know, and I think that you have to really dig deep, I think, and find what is going to work for you. What makes you fulfilled? What brings you joy? What makes you feel like you're fulfilling your purpose in life? And for me, grabbing onto my purpose that I feel like I was put on this earth to do changed a lot of things. And that wasn't just my music and what I wanted to do with that. That was being a family man. That was getting married. That was, you know, trying to be the best possible man that I could be. And I still am learning that constantly. And I still have shortcomings and I still slip up. But I don't let them derail me from my dailies, you know, as we call it. I'm a big meditation guy. And I think maybe it'll benefit some people out there, so I'll share what I do. There's a meditation called the I Am Meditation by a man named Dr. Wayne Dyer. And I haven't been as good about doing it every day, but I try to do it at least a few times a week while I'm at work, while I'm in bed. It's been a really powerful tool for me. Meditation has changed everything for me. And I still have a hard time sometimes disconnecting from my own personal agendas to take the time to tune into other people's agendas. And I think that that's an important piece too, is an aspect of service. Whatever that looks like for you, it doesn't have to be going to the soup kitchen or doing this or doing that. But I think that's a huge part for me. I think when I started getting sober, one of the biggest things that put me into that position to be ready to do that is, while living homelessly, there were so many people I wanted to help that had been living like that for most of their lives, right? And I didn't have hardly any money, or I'd have to ask my dad, can you send me some money so I can eat? And I end up giving half that food away. My dad gets so mad. I'm sending you that money for you. But it always came back to me. Yeah. Always came back to me. You know, and I made it a point to help those people. And some of the ways that I could serve were just playing guitar on the beach some days with people that were ignored and neglected by everyday society, that were looked down upon, that were shamed because they had mental health issues or addiction issues, or they smelled bad or whatever it may be. I sat with them every day, all day, and I'd sit there and I'd play guitar. And there was a kid that his name was Justin, came over to listen to me play one day. And I love playing Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. It's a song that my uncle used to play. And I play that song often for any of the family and friends that I've lost. Right. And I'm playing that one day, and I look out the corner of my eye, and this kid's just bawling. And I just didn't stop. I just kept going. And then I went right into another song, and he just came up to me after and just gave me a big hug. He said, I really needed that today. I just really needed to feel that light today.
That's awesome. And it sounds like music's been a big part of your recovery. If people want to find out more about your music, Tyler, where do they go?
So Facebook is probably the best one that I'm good at posting things on, upcoming events and stuff like that. So it's facebook.com/Tyler Gould Music. That's Tyler, G-O-U-L-D, music. I'm also on Spotify, iTunes, all those things. I've got one track out right now, and I've got more coming on the way. But that's where you can find me. You can also visit Tyler-Gould.com.
Awesome. Dr. Matt, what do you think about Tyler's story?
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, I think it emphasizes the importance of family. And so I have a question. And the question is, do you feel like your sister's dream about your grandfather has come true in your life?
I think every day, my family members that have passed on and others come in a form of angels or whatever you guys want to call them to guide me. I'm a firm believer that there's other forces out there beyond our understanding and that I have to be willing to take the action. But if you listen to the nudge, it's there. And I feel her influence on me every day, without a doubt. Like, without a doubt, I can say that I know that she's had a part in this. I mean, my life is completely flipped around in more ways than I could ever imagine. I mean, everything that I've ever dreamt about, all the things that I've ever desired have started to come true. And I don't say that in a way to brag or to puff my chest out in any way, but to just let other people know that it's there for the taking. But you have to let your mind and your whole soul see it first. You've got to let your mind go there and believe it full-heartedly. And those things will start to – and you have to recognize when you're given a little puzzle piece to get you to that next step. At least I have to, and I can only speak from my experience, but there's so many times that it's like the most minor little thing from like with for music for me, right? My wife talked me into going to an open mic night one night and then walking across the street to a record shop, and I ended up playing there and I ended up meeting somebody that's made everything come true just from walking into a record shop called Platinum Sports and Music Memorabilia down in Provo. I mean, the person that I met there changed my entire life in the course of my career and in many personal ways too. And you just have to be willing to listen, I think.
I love that.
Listen to the nudge. I think that's a good thing.
That should be the title of your next album.
There you go. That's a good idea. And just before we get going, I think the other thing is really take the time to care and listen to other people that need help. Don't be afraid to reach out and help someone, because I think anybody that has a little bit of light in their heart, I think that their purpose is to carry that light into dark places that don't get it. And to let, even if you know that that person maybe never is going to do anything that you advise them to do, even if you know they're going to spend that dollar on something stupid, sometimes that stupid thing is the only thing that keeps that person from killing themselves that day or from just being in absolute agony. And I think that's why people are here. We're here to help one another get to wherever it is that we're supposed to be. And I think if you're not doing that, then you're not going to be where you need to be. And I also think that you have to take the time to make sure that your house is in order. You know, if your house is not in order, then you're not going to be able to help anybody else. And I just think that helping other people, whatever that looks like, is a huge key of not only being sober, but just being happy and feeling fulfilled in life.
I love that. We often say, you can't fill other people's cup if your cup's empty.
True.
Tyler, thank you for stopping by. We do appreciate it. Stick around because we're going to release one of his songs right here on the feed. You're listening to Project Recovery, brought to you by our friends at knowyourscript.org. And don't forget, Project Recovery is what, Dr. Matt?
It's a KSL podcast.
Amen.
All right. How's it going, everybody? My name's Tyler Gould. I'm about to play an original song for you called Tainted, which is written by myself and a friend of mine named Madison Mon, as we struggled through addiction and our own vices, and is for those that feel that they struggle with the same things. I just want you guys to know that you're not alone. This one's called Tainted. I hope you enjoy.
Slow down, young child. You got a ways to go. You spent your whole life digging yourself a hole. Well, I climb like you climb those walls now, like I can't get out. And it sure can feel like something's holding you down. Am I tainted by the things in my past? Tainted, yeah, yeah. tainted, are you tainted, are we tainted, man? Tainted by the things of my past. Now why would you go and do the same as I? Cause it's no life when you get high just to get by, but I found myself doing it most of the time. I ruined my life with a pinch prick. Think I learned my lesson when I lost my uncle to the same. I was the same old game. The scars on my arms rip her apart, and she can't sleep cause I can't sleep, and she knows that I've been coming up hard. I kick and I push, go back to my bush, and there's no limit to the things that I push. Yes, I'm on one, but I love this stuff that I'm on. Come on, son, it's all that echoes in my thoughts. Well, I'm tainted by the things in my past. Tainted, yeah, yeah. Am I tainted? Are you tainted? Are we tainted, man? Tainted by the things in my past. Are you tainted? Are we tainted, man? Tainted by the things in my past.
If you guys like what you heard, please be sure to go and check me out on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to your music. It's there. Again, my name is Tyler Gould. That's G-O-U-L-D, and that song is called Tainted. Thank you, guys, and have a wonderful day.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.